again to Jim Brown's Outrig Capercast, number 43. This is my take on the R2AK, the race to Alaska. I'm speaking to you through my computer just 3 days before the vernal equinox 2017. That means my old trimaran Scrimshaw will be 45 years old on June 21st coming up. She was launched on the vernal equinox 1972. As many of you know, she is now under the custodianship of Bruce Matlack. Bruce and I are true friends, all right? And as you regular listeners know, we managed to get together just a couple of months ago down there in Florida for the Everglades Challenge race. We were hanging out in Scrimshaw down in the Florida Keys so that I could bring you the first of my ongoing reports on the hybrid wing sail. Also, many of you know my old friend Joe Hudson, the cartoonist from Big Sur. We've been knocking around together on various capers for over 40 years. But I hadn't seen Joe since over a year ago when we went to Cuba together. So when I had this hankering to go out for the start of the R2AK, I knew that Bruce Matlack was going to be in the Pacific Northwest with his motorhome, so I asked Joe if he would like to meet us up there, and now things started coming together. Joe told me that Steve Short, our great traveling companion for those expeditions down the California coast and the Baja Sea of Cortez in our Windriders, that Steve Short was going to be up there too with his little West White Potter on a private expedition up through the Straits of Georgia. So he agreed to meet up with us up there, too. And Bruce decided to bring his friend Carla, who is responsible for keeping us straight sometimes. And then there's Zita Kelly, who has often been our sometimes full-time keeper on these capers. Zita says, somehow we all seem to just keep showing up. And she lives out there in Olympia, Washington, so she wouldn't have far to go. So we all agreed to congregate there in Victoria, British Columbia, early June. Now, actually, the R2AK starts at Port Townsend, Washington. And it just so happens that my son Russell and his wife Ashlyn live in that town. They've known about this race for the last 3 years, but this year Russell got this bug in his tail that he was going to enter. He had sold his big Pro a few years ago. Now has a very spiffy, massively refurbished Goujon 32 catamaran. So with my son competing in such an interesting race, I just had to get out there, and I dragged all my friends with me so we could be a cheering session for Russell Brown. Okay, that's the preamble and the cast of characters. And the first lap of the race is from Port Townsend, just 40 miles across the Straits of Juan de Fuca to Victoria, B.C. Something over 50 boats were entered in this caper, all types and sizes. The only rule in the whole race is no engine. The vessel must be either human-powered and or wind-powered. But because the course is so demanding, from Victoria, B.C., up through the Inside Passage to Ketchikan, Alaska, 750 miles, with notoriously long periods of calm this time of year, the human power component becomes very important, and that limits the size of the vessel. It's pretty hard to pedal or paddle or row a vessel that's, you know, over 35 feet long. But it also gives some advantages to vessels that are entirely human powered. So this contest attracts stand-up paddleboarders, kayak paddlers, and canoe rowers. And while there are no official classes in the race, no separation of boat types, and no official distinctions drawn between boats carrying a crew and those who are going single-handed, nonetheless, the race itself tends to separate out the types so that the big, powerful multi-hulls carrying a crew have a real boat race among themselves, as do the monohullers, the paddlers, and the peddlers, and the single-handers. There are two prizes. The first to finish, no matter what boat and under whatever circumstances, receives $10,000, which, after all, doesn't really pay for getting your affairs in order to make such a caper. And the second boat to finish in Ketchikan receives a set of steak knives. That's it. Everybody else is in it just to finish, if they can just get to the end That's victory. So the first lap from Port Townsend to Victoria, B.C. is the, you know, the filter. Anyone who gets to Victoria can continue on the rest of the race, where it started again at noon on Sunday morning, June 11th. Now that, incidentally, is just a week ago today, the 18th, and usually the winners finish in 5 to 7 days, so the winners have already come in. But this Capercast is not to be an accounting of the race itself. There's far too much detail, but it's all available on the race's website, R2AK, the letter R, the numeral 2, and then AK.com. You'll find it. There's a bunch of wonderful stuff on there, including videos, and there's a tracker. All the vessels have a so-called spot tracker, a transponder that talks to the satellite, so the race organizers are supposed to be able to tell us on screen where everybody is all the time. So it's been a great kick for me and Joanna to follow the tracker and watch the progress of our son. The team name for his boat is Port Townsend Watercraft, or PT Watercraft. That's a shameless plug for his kit boat company. And he's sponsored in part, of course, by West System Epoxy, as it says on the side of his boat. Now, of course, the boats with crew can afford to continue sailing at night. In fact, they can run continuously the whole course if they have a strong crew. But the single-handers, of course, have to stop and rest. And as I mentioned, this tends to really separate the fleet. So as I speak, Sunday the 17th, it appears that Russell is in a position to at least do well among the single-handers. But there are other elements that tend to separate the fleet, wind and current. Right from the first day, that qualifying run from Port Townsend over to Victoria, Russell and most of the sailing multi-hulls managed to arrive in Victoria before a substantial change in the weather. In fact, there was a whole pack of little boats out there almost within sight of Victoria when the wind turned around and blew like hell against them and just scattered them all through the San Juan Islands. The race organizers had good reason to be scared. Lots of people alone in a cold wind knocking around out there overnight. The Coast Guard did get involved. There were a couple of rescues. But the front passed, and most of the boats were able to make it in to Victoria on their own steam during the next couple of days. But before the real start from Victoria, the skipper's meeting featured a presentation by a woman who was the director of search and rescue for the Canadian Coast Guard for all of British Columbia. And she was very supportive of the race, but she put the fear in everyone by saying things like, "Be sure to wear your life jackets so at least I can find the bodies." Of course, in cold water, the big danger is hypothermia. So she put a heavy emphasis on preparation and gear. And she explained with slides of a map just where the Coast Guard resources were located. She explained that in the southern part of the course, up through the Georgia Straits and as far as Campbell River, there were plenty of search and rescue resources, boats and a helicopter. But beyond that, things really thinned out. You were getting into territory where if something went wrong, something could really go wrong and you might not be able to get help. However, there were two checkpoints along the route where every boat had to check in as it went by. And there would probably be VHF contact with other boats in the race or with somebody on shore who could hear if you were in distress. And every boat was required to check in by radio every 24 hours. The main thing is that the course took the boats up through some pretty wild water. A few short passages exposed to the open sea, but most of the course inside of big high islands in territory where there are enormous tides, and these tides generate currents, tidal currents running between the islands and the mainland. And very often those currents are reversing with each tide. And the area has notoriously fickle winds. Very light airs are common, as are gales. So you can see that a very great deal of seamanship is involved in planning the passage so as to try to catch the current running through certain channels favorably, deciding if there's enough wind to sail against the current, and deciding when to stop and anchor and let the contrary current run out and then catch it when it changes. And all of this is particularly difficult if one is single-handing because added to the schedule is the necessary stop for rest. This time of year, there's only about 4 or 5 hours of darkness up there. There's a nice long gloaming until about 11 o'clock at night, and the false dawn shows up at about 3. And running at night can be very dangerous because the waters are notoriously strewn with logs. Because of the lumber industry, there's a lot of trees that end up in the rivers and they get washed out. So if you're going fast at night, you're really asking for it. And some of the guys ask for it. And as far as I know, there was only one boat that struck a log and had to retire from the race. At least so far. Of course, it's still going on. Russell refuses to run at night. And the real reason that he decided to go single-handed was that he did not want to be trying to sleep down below with somebody else on the helm running at night. He wouldn't be able to sleep anyway. For getting caught out at night, he had a big light that would fasten underneath his bowsprit and shine out onto the ocean and not shine back onto the boat. Very important for being able to see where you're going, particularly in foggy conditions. Oh, that's another thing, fog and rain. So Russell's been out for 7.5 days now, and Joanna and I have had a great time following his progress on the tube, on the computer. He's got a day or two to go. And for that reason, we're not going to be there for the finish. It was impossible to make travel plans, but his wife, Ashlyn, is going to be there, and Russell says that what he's looking forward to the most is a slow cruise home with Ashlyn. Well, so much for the finish. I'd like to tell you about the start. I was not there for the start of the first leg at Port Townsend, but I was there in Victoria. And I must say that the city of Victoria, British Columbia, is a very civilized place. In a way, it looks more British than Britain. But the people were especially accommodating, and the city's built around a very nice, tight harbor. And at the very head of the harbor, the so-called Inner Harbor, there's a beautiful little municipal marina, one big ramp going down to a collection of finger piers that would accommodate everybody competing. Some 50 boats tied up to these fingers. Local boats had to leave for this occasion. And built around the Inner Harbor, there are some significant structures, really wonderful architecture, particularly the Hotel Empress, which looks like a castle. There's a nice harborfront drive you can actually get across, and then wide walks and park areas surrounding the marina. We were blessed with a beautiful sunny day, but there was no wind. The Le Mans-type start was to be at noon, and so about 11:45, guys went around with megaphones clearing the docks, everybody off of the docks, including the competitors. And we'd all been milling around this scene for a couple of days, admiring the boats, and it was a tremendous exhibit of inventiveness. Boy, there were a lot of people who had done a lot of very clever thinking about this race, their boat for this race. And if you're interested in the boats, I highly recommend going to the website. But anyway, as noon approached, the docks were clear, everybody was up the ramp, the gate was closed. 5 minutes went out the call, and then, you know, 1 minute, and then starting to count down seconds, everybody, there were 200 or 300 people up there on the seawall, counting down the seconds, 4, 3, 2, and they opened the gates, and these guys started running down the docks. Everybody was cheering like crazy. All the dogs in town went off. And because it was noon, there was a beautiful belfry there. The bells were clanging. Everybody was cheering. And these guys pushed off from the docks and went out into a flat calm. But they all had some kind of human power necessary to complete the course. Russell's boat was fitted with a very simple and very clever pedal drive, which allows him to sit in the normal helmsman's seat facing athwartships with his hand on the tiller and pedal at the same time and also reach the sheets. Now, I think that's quite advanced. The real future for pedal power, in my view, is in combination with sail. And it's possible with Russell's drive to get the boat up to about 4 knots in calm conditions. And that's been done even with 5 people aboard. But no one peddler can last for long at that pace. In order to pace yourself down to be able to pedal for an hour or so, you'd have to be content with speeds of 2 knots or less. And it's not easy pedaling. It's not like going down a level road on a bicycle. You've got to push on those pedals because of the resistance of the water. It's in effect a marine engine. It's like going uphill all the way. But all the boats had to have some kind of human power mobility because when arriving into the outer harbor of Victoria, it is not legal to hoist sail until you're outside the breakwater. And the reason is that the harbor is an active seaplane base. Of course, there's a lot of seaplane traffic going up into British Columbia because the roads are very few roads. So as soon as everybody took to the pedals or paddles or oars, we hopped in a cab and went around the town and out onto the breakwater. It was a long walk, at least a half a mile out to the end of the breakwater. And by the time we got there, the first of the boats were just coming by. And wouldn't you know, it was the stand-up paddleboarder and a kayak that emerged around the breakwater first. That was their meat, you know, no wind, flat water. They were able to mogate and get on out there before everybody else. But we watched as the larger boats set sail, and Russell did give us a flyby. He sailed very slowly past the end of the breakwater, and it was, you know, go Russell and fair winds. And between me and my friends and he and all his friends, he had a real cheering section. I feel very fortunate to have most of my friends know both of my sons. And I've been much relieved over the years that neither Stephen nor Russell decided to get into open ocean racing. I've done enough walking the beach worrying about them and all my clients out there on the big blue briny, you know, many of them having never built the birdhouse, but they've built a seagoing yacht and never been offshore in the dark, you know. Relatively speaking, both Steve and Russ have a vast experience at both building and sailing. And I must say that Joanna and I were both quite proud that Russell decided to take on this contest, and I'll have to wait till next week to tell you how it comes in, okay? He may well have finished by the time this is posted, but anyone interested in what's going on can go to the website R2, that is the letter R, then the numeral 2, then the letters AK.com. It's typical of this new kind of yacht racing that's going on. They call it the raid racing. It's really becoming very popular. These events are going on all over the world now. I think it's the future of yachting, and it's happening entirely outside the yacht clubs, just as the Hobie Cat revolution happened. It makes me believe that pedal power has a bright future in these endeavors, especially when combined with sail in a hot sailboat. There's some wonderful design challenges ahead. Try to work it out so that you can pedal in the comms while being able to sail. And, of course, if there are zephyrs, which there usually are at least light air zephyrs floating around, you can get the boat moving a little bit, bring the apparent wind around ahead, and the next thing you know, you're sailing. And when the boat really starts to sail, of course, the pedal power, the pedal drive is nothing but in the way, and so it's going to, you know, evolve into folding propellers and kick up lower units and all kinds of wonderful things. And I personally think it won't be long before the hybrid wing will show up in these races, because the ease of handling of this new means of extracting power from the wind is the real attraction. To me, it's not just the speed, it's the seaworthiness, the ease of handling, and the ability to turn the power off simply by allowing the wing to weathercock into the wind. So here's a question for you, dear listener. I'm suggesting that here at Outrig Capercast, we arrange for a design contest. Let's talk about putting up a design contest for the R2AK and the Everglades Challenge, for a boat that's designed expressly for single-handing in those conditions. Anybody interested? I think it'd be a blast. I'd even like to try to draw something, even though I can't really draw anymore. What do you all think? Huh? You got any ideas? Let me know, please. Until next week, then, fair wind.